Katie, thank you very much. It's my delight to be here on this campus where I've been before. I had the great privilege of living at St. John's College on both of my previous visits, and I can assure you American students would be very envious of the high quality of your cuisine. The meals there were really superb, at least by my southern redneck judgment. And so I hope you'll be aware of how fortunate you are to have the kind of meals you have at a place like St. John's. I've lectured at Regent College. I'm lecturing tomorrow at Carey College. But this is my first time actually at UBC. And thanks to the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, thanks to Katie Calloway, a doctoral student in English, and to others, not least of all, Bill Weimer, a friend who goes back now for a decade, I'm getting to be here again, so I appreciate very much your coming. Let me talk with you a bit about Fyodor Dostoevsky. I'm going to be working on the assumption that you have read The Brothers Karamazov. So may I have a show of hands to see whether I have made a false or true assumption? Good, very good, very good. Because there's not time for a plot summary. In fact, it's a plot so remarkably complex that a whole hour to try to summarize it. Instead, I'm going to be making the argument, which is actually very close to the argument made by Rowan Williams, in what is, I think, now hands down the single best study of Dostoevsky. And it's for sale, as you've heard, at the back of the room after this class. Rowan Williams, as most of you know, is Archbishop of Canterbury. A lot of you may not know that he's also a theologian of the very first rank. A man who, whatever your own politics may be, should not be linked to a judgment of Rowan Williams. In a way that I find quite salutary, his literary criticism, and in large part his theological work, has little to do with controversial political stands he has taken. So if you happen to be inimical to those political stands, don't let that discourage you from reading his really splendid book. He wrote the book in 6 weeks, which is very frightening. I've been at work for 6 years on a book I can't bring to completion. In most cases, he provides his own translations of Dostoevsky, which is to say he's completely fluent in Russian. He, in fact, did his dissertation at Oxford under Donald McKinnon on Vladimir Lossky. Some of you know Lossky is, I think, without question, the single most important Eastern Orthodox theologian of the 20th century. So Rowan Williams, unlike yours truly, comes at this business as a real expert. He is not simply the archbishop who takes off 6 weeks of vacation to air a few ideas about Dostoevsky. This man is what C.S. Lewis said of Tolkien, I think, could be said of Rowan Williams and Dostoevsky. Lewis famously said, Tolkien is inside language. Tolkien does not use language the way most of us does. He inhabits language. I think that could be said of Rowan Williams. He inhabits the world of Dostoevsky. The argument I want to make this afternoon, largely following him, is that Dostoevsky's novel, his last and I think without question greatest work, has good cause for being called the premier novel of the modern world. I'll stop in a minute to say what I mean by modernity, but let me say a word about what I mean by premier. And by that I mean that Dostoevsky confronts the largest, most difficult questions that modernity raises without turning his face from them, but rather instead openly engaging them in non-dismissive ways. We're going to see in a few minutes, he takes Ivan Karamazov's absolutely unanswerable objection to the suffering of innocent children with utmost seriousness. He will not simply cast it aside and say, That's too bad. We must bond now. He takes the Grand Inquisitor scene, likewise, with a kind of rigor that it really demands. He doesn't baptize Alyosha as the hero of that novel. In fact, we're going to see he makes some severe criticisms of Alyosha, who is, as you know, the young monk, who would seem to be, as one of Dostoevsky's many narrators announces him to be, the hero. So it's by Dostoevsky's utterly honest and profound wrestling with the great, troublesome, vexing modern questions and offering answers to them that are not, again, knocked down answers. They are not easy answers. They are not kind of abstractly doctrinal answers in which he proposes, as it were, to this mathematical problem, this neat solution. On the contrary, his solution is fraught with complexity and difficulty in itself. As we're going to see, for Roland Williams, that's what makes it so Christian. That the Christian response to life in general, and more specifically, to modernity in particular, is itself fraught, complex, difficult. I like the saying of the late Richard John Neuhaus, who, when thrown up the question, what isn't the gospel fundamentally simple at its core? So that even the most unlearned, even the most uneducated, even those who have the least sophisticated understanding of the world, isn't the gospel nonetheless made for them, and therefore at its core, really very simple? Karl Barth was once asked if he could be made to summarize the gospel in a single sentence. He said, easy. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Well, it is that simple. But Neuhaus said, remember, Christian simplicity always lies on the far side of difficulty. That's exactly right. We have sanction, if we're a Christian, for getting to such simple claims as Jesus loves me, this I know, only if we have worked through the horrific difficulties that attend any easy proclamation of that claim. Let me say finally, before diving into this this work, that Dostoevsky has been, for me, a life-changing writer. T.S. Eliot famously said, most of us spend our lives being embarrassed about our childhood heroes of a literary or philosophical or theological kind. We have to get over the people we once admired and exalted because we come to see that we've exhausted their possibilities. We have, in a certain sense, exceeded them, gone beyond them, and we kind of look back in astonishment upon ourselves and saying, oh my gosh, I once thought he or she hung the moon, that there was nothing else to be said. He said, therefore, the task of every person, Christian or not, is to find a writer, a thinker, a hero, who and which cannot be exhausted. Texts or figures whose lives and whose work therefore command ever deeper exploration, knowing that the further and deeper you dig, the less likely you are to exhaust them. And Eliot famously said there are only two of those, this is Eliot's snobbery, that met that test for him, Shakespeare and Dante. Dostoevsky and many others, I might add, meet that test for me. I've taught Dostoevsky and I've taught this novel not every year, but almost every year since I began my teaching life in 1971. So I've read it a lot of times. And yet I don't ever think I've come close to mastering this novel. It's not, as so to speak, under my belt so that I can walk into the classroom and simply lead students along to see precisely what this novel means and so they can get it down. Because remember, the essence of a great work of art is that it does not submit to abstract summary. That, by the way, is going to take us just a minute into the whole modern project. The modern project is about extracting universal, timeless, placeless ideas out of particular texts and out of particular traditions so as to retrieve them apart from their historical, personal, textual situation. That's simply false. That's exactly what we shouldn't do, even sometimes we think we do. I gave a lecture last night over at Regent on Flannery O'Connor, and she was so opposed to that notion that one time when a student wrote to ask her, "Miss O'Connor, can you please explain the meaning of this story?" She said, "No, I cannot. For if I could explain the meaning of the story, I would have had no reason to have written it. I could have simply given you the meaning." She said what that kind of approach to literature does is to reduce literature and poetic text to algebraic equations whose aim is find X. And she added with her typical wit, once you found X, you can forget it. You cannot forget Dostoevsky. He leaves on us a permanent mark. And that's what Harold Bloom describes as the real mark of a classic. He says a classic is a work that makes us rearrange the furniture of our lives. It makes us rethink all of our basic presuppositions. It casts us into a new mode of imagining the world. And that's what Dostoevsky does. To my point, then. The modern Enlightenment project, I think, is the chief background for understanding Dostoevsky's work. I think it's very important to note that while there is a lot of anti-Enlightenment sentiment going around, as I was saying to my former student and very fine doctoral student here, Katie Calloway, she said, "I'm tired of people bashing up the Enlightenment." Well, I am too. So long as we understand that the Enlightenment is fundamentally a Christian product. That is to say, the Enlightenment, as I understand it, and of course there are several Enlightenments, not just one, but as a whole, the Enlightenment is a Christian heresy. It could never have come to be without Christianity. Because at the core of Christianity, of course, lies the whole idea of freedom. Paul says in Galatians, very plainly, "For freedom I have set you free." That's the core of the gospel, he says. Exactly. Rightly. As the Buddhists say, spot on. The Enlightenment is about the project of freedom, but now radically recast. And so I want to say very briefly how the idea of freedom gets recast in the Enlightenment, so as to show you how Dostoevsky, in part, embraces that Enlightenment idea of freedom, while finally offering a radical critique of it, and also offering an alternative to it. An emerging kind of intellectual historical consensus is that much of our contemporary mischief can be derived from the whole nominalist movement in the late Middle Ages. That under such important, notice well, Christian theologians as Occam and Scotus, we began to understand the whole nature of God and of human language in a drastically different way. A nominalism holds that we can't really know anything in and of and for itself. We can only know things as they appear, notice well, as they appear to be. And of course, that finally gets transferred. I'm doing some really cheap and shoddy intellectual history here. Please don't emerge from this room and say, "Hey, I now understand the Enlightenment because I heard 5 minutes talk about it." But basically what happens, that gets transferred over to God, so that God becomes almost entirely understood in terms of will. Occam famously, horribly said that the incarnation could have occurred just as well in a donkey as in Jesus of Nazareth. There was only by God's own arbitrary will, choice, decision. You hear my modern magical words we all use every day. God acts in the very same way, in an arbitrary, willful, autonomous decision, not to enter a donkey as the incarnation, but enter this Jewish carpenter and rabbi. Through a whole complex series of moves, that increasing distantiation of the knower and the known becomes ever wider until, by the time of Descartes and the time of Newton, nature lies dead. Nature no longer refers to anything beyond itself. It is simply a flat, unidimensional thing which we can objectively know. Notice how epistemology moves to the forefront as the foremost form of philosophy, which we can objectively know and above all master to our own uses. There's a very frightening passage in Descartes where he says, I want to master nature. Now that's language that you would never have heard from any Greek, any Roman, any Christian of the first 12, 13 centuries. That kind of language begins to dominate Western discourse because nature has now been denuded of any transcendent reference. Nature is no longer analogous to anything outside itself. Nature simply is this process of largely efficient causes where everything can be explained not too distantly, as of course Newton did with the dropping of that bottle top. Those are the forces of gravity that can be calculated and determined. And if you, in fact, knew enough about my own historical background, you could tell why I dropped that. And thus everything winds up being reduced to not the original four causes of which Aristotle spoke and which Thomas takes over, but only the single efficient cause, so that the notion emerges that every single effect in the world can be explained by its antecedent causes. Therefore, if you know those causes, you know the outcome which they will inevitably produce. Well, once nature is denuded, therefore, of its analogical, transcendent, mystical power and reference, and becomes a dead thing which we are meant to manipulate, control, and master, then look what happens to us. We become the new lords of the universe. We become those who are able to exercise that mastery because we have no essential dependence upon either that natural world or much less upon the divine order. And so, and simplifying hugely and horribly, I'm afraid, what emerges is the notion of the new autonomous, self-directed, self-generating, self-identifying individual. That word emerges in a way that had never been used before. In the ancient world, God was the only individual in the sense that God is undivided, what the word individual means. But now we have a whole new species of human beings who are individuals. They're not divided by anything because they are these unitary, solitary selves that make the world as they wish it to be, mainly by maneuvering the natural order, but also by beginning to maneuver the human order as well. Some of you know that in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a notorious verdict was rendered with a phrase there that is attributed to Judge Anthony Kennedy. That's debated because these court decisions are rendered anonymously. You know who voted for and who voted against, but you don't know who wrote a particular passage. And there in this unbelievable phrase from, it appears, Anthony Kennedy, who allegedly is a Roman Catholic, said, every human being has the right to make up reality for himself. That is the modern project come to its final, if I may say, rotten end. But it becomes more than simply the development of this new solitary, self-defining, self-authenticating individual. It has radical political implications as well. So let me speak about them just for a minute, and religious. I commend to you the work, if you don't know it, of John Kavanaugh. He's a young American theologian working at St. Thomas, University of St. Thomas, in St. Paul, Minnesota. A number of books, a number of articles. Here's what Kavanaugh has done to revolutionize our understanding of modern politics. The standard explanation of what happens in the 17th century, somewhat in the 16th before it, is that the horrible wars of religion that followed the Protestant Reformation, where allegedly Catholics and Protestants were slaughtering each other in the name of their own individual Christianities, plural, had to be brought to a halt. And the only way to bring it to a halt was to put political control on this endlessly fractious, divisive, vociferating Christianity. And so you develop the whole notion of tolerance, most famously inscribed, of course, by John Locke in his letter on toleration. And that these religious wars, therefore, necessitated the whole modern political project, because Christians were going to go on carving each other up over these little, minuscule, insignificant doctrinal matters. John Kavanaugh has shown that is flat out false. That's just plain wrong. That many of the so-called wars of religion had Catholics slaughtering Catholics and Protestants slaughtering Protestants because they were not fighting in the name of their Christianity. They were fighting in the name of what is the essential mark of modernity, which is the emergence of the omnipotent nation state. That's what those battles were about. The new hegemony of political power that had come to be focused around these particular nation states that had never before existed, and that's what those wars were being fought over, was over political, economic, territorial rights, and not over Christians debating the nature of the Trinity, for example. And the result was something like the following. Let me read to you from Kavanaugh. He says that what happens once the nation state emerges is that Christianity becomes increasingly privatized, increasingly constricted to the inner realm, or else, that's what happened with the separation of church and state in the United States, or else via the established church, say in England, and other places, so that the state can put its control on the church by making it the established church, or by privatizing it, as we did in the U.S. So in either case, it is the state that is fundamentally controlling the life of faith. My way of putting it to my students is that the whole idea of the separation of church and state is, if you Christians will shut up and behave yourselves, we will tolerate you. But if you start trying to move outside your church walls, and you start making some larger claims about the nature of reality, then we will not tolerate you. We've got to have this meeting of the minds, where everybody, all people of goodwill and good intention, can agree on these large abstract principles. And if you Christians violate those, then you're out of line. And of course, James I declared himself to have divine right. Well, no king in the Middle Ages ever thought of himself as having divine right. The king always served under the higher authority of the church. But now there is no higher authority in modernity than the nation state. This is what Kavanaugh says about it. As religion is therefore removed from its specific ecclesial, i.e. church context, Christianity becomes for the first time a religion. Never before had Christianity been referred to as a religion. One of a genus of plural religions. In the U.S., we no longer speak of departments of religion, but of religious studies, where each of the religions are treated as belonging to the genus of this larger abstract thing called religion, none of them having any claims that could be taken with any kind of absolute seriousness. He goes on. This crucial move, as we've seen in Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau, is the separation of religion and church, unless the church is absorbed by the state, as in Hobbes, or unless religion is made separate from the state and therefore tolerated, as in Locke. He says, this state sovereign becomes a very jealous God. That's exactly what it is. By the way, my Canadian friends tell me that what bothers them most when they come to Washington, D.C., are all those huge pagan monuments along the mall. You know, the gigantic obelisk to Washington. You know, the kind of recreated pantheon for Jefferson. And on the opposite end, this huge temple unto Lincoln. And I happen, if I may speak complimentarily of you, to be in Victoria 8 or 10 years ago on Canada Day. And I have to say, it was a real delight. I didn't get any of that kind of really, maybe things have changed in the decade, any of the kind of super boastfulness of, the glory of the Canadian state. I mean, people this day are kind of having a good time eating picnic lunches on the lawn of the Capitol in Victoria. That's not the way we do it, I can guarantee you. Come to the States on July 4th for a good lesson. The church, above all, must be defeated in order for salvation to take place. But more generally, any association which interferes with that direct relation between the sovereign and the individual becomes suspect. See, nothing can stand between the nation state and the solitary individual. If the church gets in the way, it better get out of the way. At stake in all the so-called wars of religion was the attempt by the nobility to protect local prerogatives against the assertion of a centralized royal or imperial control. When Hobbes and Rousseau theorized the emergent state in the 17th and 18th centuries, they understood quite clearly the imperative to defeat the lesser associations within the state body in order to vanquish multiplicity. You can't have multiplicity in the hegemonic nation state. As we're going to discover in just a minute, Dostoevsky is all about multiplicity that must not be coerced. Locke was less clear on this point, but in practice, the modern sovereign state has been defined by its usurping of power from lesser communal bodies. May I repeat that? The modern sovereign nation state has been defined by its usurping of power from lesser communal bodies. And, he goes on to say, the power of the state grew in concert with the rise of capitalism because of direct state subsidies for business and international trade, the development of state-sanctioned standardized monetary and taxation systems, and the emergence of a centralized legal system, which made possible the commodification and contractualization of land, goods, but most especially labor. In other words, the impersonal and centralized state accompanied the invention of the autonomous individual, liberated from the confines of the traditional group, and now relating only to other individuals. Community is undermined at its core. All you have now are individuals relating to other individuals. We're going to see that's exactly what Father Zosima sets his face against like flint. The idea that the only relation we have is one individual related to another individual, and there is not any kind of radical communal reality. And he goes on to say, and they're related primarily on the basis of contract. Property, including one's own self in the form of one's labor, becomes alienable. Thus were both born the capitalist and the wage laborer at the same time. I'm doing a study of G.K. Chesterton. This book I can't ever bring to a conclusion. That's precisely his premise. Precisely his premise. That the capitalist and the wage laborer are brought into being at the same time. Well, the point then being this, that Dostoevsky wants to wrestle with this newly emerging thing of the autonomous individual, which he rightly foresaw happening in the West. He went to London for the World's Fair in 18... Someone help me. Early 60s, late 50s. You would happen to know when the World's Fair was held in London? And I can't tell where the sound's coming from. Good guesses. Anyhow, the central the showpiece of the World's Fair was the Crystal Palace. 51. Got it. 1851, the Great Crystal Palace was the first gigantic glass building. This was thought to be the ultimate demonstration of human mastery of the natural order. You didn't need to have bricks and stone. You could now build a building out of glass. Dostoevsky said, my aim is to smash the Crystal Palace. Because he sees the implication of that whole idea. Now, to Dostoevsky proper. He has been, in my view, largely misread along the following terms. I'm going to give you just a brief account of the major misreading of Dostoevsky, because he did make some pretty serious statements that came back to haunt him. I think I won't write this. This is a statement that you ought to ponder. He said, if I had to choose between Christ and the truth, I would choose Christ. Now, that sounds like gross irrationalism. That sounds like a repudiation of reason. That sounds like a rigid divide between Athens and Jerusalem. However, what Rowan Williams does is to show magnificently that when he used the word truth, Dostoevsky was using it in the Enlightenment sense, in the sense I've just tried to describe. So, if forced to choose between Christ and the Enlightenment, there's no doubt about what he would choose. My point being that Dostoevsky is not an irrationalist, as he is often thought to be. In fact, one of the moments in the Brothers K, which Rowan Williams rightly criticizes, is one that many people exalt. Listen to this. This is the advice of Alyosha to Dmitri. Love life more than the meaning of life. I mean, undergraduates come out of the woodwork when they hear that kind of claim. Don't worry about understanding the way the world works. Don't beat your brains trying to figure out these huge philosophical debates. You know, don't butt your head against the wall with this gigantic complex idea of the dual natures of Christ, the Trinity, and so forth. Just love life. Lord Williams points out that Dostoevsky spent the novel undermining that bad advice that Alyosha, the young monk, gives to Dmitri by showing that it's precisely by understanding the meaning of life, and only by so understanding it, that one can love life. And that an irrational love of life is indeed very, very dangerous. So, I think to read Dostoevsky as a kind of proto-existentialist is wrong. And that's how he has been read in many quarters, and how he is still being read in many quarters, as a kind of early anticipator of the existentialist movement, of the whole notion that existence must precede essence. You can't talk about reason until, first of all, you have existence itself. I think that's false. So, to Dostoevsky's project, then, and how I think it therefore beats the Enlightenment head-on, but offers a drastic alternative to it. First of all, his massive innovation in narrative method. If you've read 10 pages in Dostoevsky, you know that things get very confusing in a very quick hurry. As you get voice over against counter-voice, you get this angle of vision over that angle of vision, so that you have a radical plurality of narrators. Now, some people will say, well, that means Dostoevsky is a complete sold-out subjectivist, so that all we have are individual stories that people have to tell individually, and they don't cohere into any kind of larger story. No. Dostoevsky is determined to honor what was indeed a valid Enlightenment breakthrough, that each person does have their story. Each person does view the world from an angle unlike anybody else. For example, I saw an interview with Pope Benedict XVI, where his interlocutor thought he had him really trapped. He said, this is when he was Cardinal Ratzinger. Cardinal Ratzinger, tell me how many ways there are to God. That's a have you stopped beating your wife kind of question. He said brilliantly, as many human beings as there are. Right on. So, Dostoevsky wants to retain the plurality of human viewpoints, and not to sell out to the idea of what Bakhtin calls unfinalizability, that's a fat word, but rather to honor a radical kind of plurality, not only among characters with their varying voices, but within characters. If you know old Theodore, for example, he's one of the most frightening characters I've ever met, because you remember what he did on the day his first wife died? He went out into the streets and sang the Te Deum. Thanks be unto thee, O Lord, I no longer have this woman to chain me down. He says, I have in me the heart of Sodom. He then turns right around and starts talking about the immense care he has for these four sons of him, and says, at the same time, I have the heart of Sodom. I have the heart of the Madonna. For Dostoevsky, that is precisely the radically contradictory character of human being. It's not that these can't coincide in one being, that in fact they all the time coincide in one person. And so he invents this really drastic new narrative method of multiplicity of points of view, varying states of consciousness, in order to try to show how the Enlightenment was right, up to a point, that the world is really radically free, not because there is no God, because that is precisely the quality of God. That God is never coercive. that the essence of the divine character is the refusal of coercion, and always and only willing to exercise persuasion. And so Dostoevsky lets characters, as we say, have their head. He gives them free rein, because that is indeed what God does. God will not coerce human character. And therefore, Dostoevsky's plots are open-ended. I don't know if Dr. Cottle made it here today. She's here on the back row. She was really troubled at the end because things were not tied up into a neat little bundle and said, here, reader. And she was rightly troubled. Many of my students get to the end of the Brothers K and are disappointed because things are not brought into a final kind of easy or ready conclusion. That's precisely Dostoevsky's point. Precisely Dostoevsky's point. That to live amidst uncertainty is at the core of living faithfully. That if we have to have absolute certainty in order to live, then by definition, we have committed idolatry. That life at its core is burdened with a salutary uncertainty, not an accursed uncertainty. And that Dostoevsky is then trying to honor that quality in this radical new notion of narration and authorial control. But more radical still, this is my second and final point. Let you have a chance to talk. Dostoevsky sees that at the center of the modern project, which claims to be freeing, which claims to be at last breaking the awful shackles of priestcraft and superstition and authoritarianism, there lies a core called nihilism. That what begins as a Christian heresy, taking the good notion of freedom and radically misconstruing and misreading it, ends with nihilism. And of course, the most articulate voice of nihilism is Ivan Karamazov. Ivan Karamazov, of course, is obsessed with the horror of innocent suffering. And he absolutely, as the British say, puts paid to all of the traditional theodicies. You probably know this word means justifying the goodness of God over against the presence of evil in the world. That's, of course, the Greek word for God. That's the word dike, meaning justice. The justice of God. Milton's about the very same project, of course. That Dostoevsky rends, as with a rapier, those theodicies, which, by the way, that word was invented, anyone know when? Not in the ancient world, but by Leibniz, the kind of quintessential modern thinker, where he wants to figure out ways in which, by a kind of mathematical knockdown argument, we can justify suffering of even the worst, most insidious kind. And the worst, most insidious kind is the suffering of children, especially children in the presence of their parents, and most especially in the presence of their mothers. And as you know, he is a collector of stories, newspaper clippings. Watch out. He's a journalist. That's a dangerous condition, by the way. He collects these newspaper clippings of horror stories about suffering children. And they are truly awful. Where a captain, for example, sicks a pack of dogs on a little boy who had chunked a little stone the size of that piece of chalk at his dogs. Some Cossack soldiers will take a baby out of the mother's arms, flip it into the air, and catch it on its bayonet as she watches. But the most horrific of all the stories that Ivan has gathered is this one. That a very young girl who had not yet learned continence, had not been sufficiently, as we say, potty trained, is made after having wet the bed with her urine to spend an entire Russian winter night in a stinking privy where the temperature is well below zero Fahrenheit, 20 or 30 below. And all night long she cries out to dear, kind God to come to her rescue. And of course, dear, kind God does not come to her rescue. And Ivan concludes from this then that he will not pay homage to this dear, kind God. In a very famous episode, incident you probably know, he said, I hereby return my ticket. I was given without my asking the ticket to life. I respectfully refuse the ticket. I return it. In other words, I will not affirm a world in which children can be allowed to suffer that way. And so he devises his very famous aphorism, which becomes the kind of defining phrase for nihilism, as especially Alyosha defines it for him, if God is dead, does anyone know the rest of it? All things are permitted. That's what Alyosha says to Ivan. If you conclude, Ivan, that God is dead, what you must also conclude is that all things are permitted, that nothing is prohibited, that there are no grounds whatsoever for any kind of moral constraint. Now, that phrase has often been used in the following fashion that Rowan Williams, I think, demonstrates not to be Dostoevsky's point. That's often been said, well, that just denies objective morality. And above all, if you get rid of the notion of God, you've got rid of the notion of the afterlife. And if people don't live in fear of being punished in the afterlife, then they're going to live in this life in whatever in the hell way they want to. That's how that phrase has often been interpreted. Get rid of God, get rid of the afterlife, and people will just live it up. People will turn to hedonism. Rowan Williams says, no, that's not the problem. That's not the problem. The problem is that once you make Ivan's move, nothing is left but the autonomous self. Not the hedonistic self, but the autonomous self. And if Ivan were therefore consistent in his autonomy, he would not make protest against the child being kept all night in a Russian privy. There are no grounds for that protest. Except, as Richard Rorty, the late Richard Rorty, very candidly said, the only grounds for preferring the manumission of slaves to slavery are aesthetic. I myself prefer a world in which there are not slaves. I cannot make any argument for a world in which there are not slaves because there is no ground for making any such argument. It's strictly an aesthetic judgment. And for Rorty, I think there's a kind of clarity, terrible, frightening honesty about that. But Dostoevsky, you see, is unmasking that. By not offering a theodicy, because there is none. There is none. You cannot justify a baby being flung in the air and caught on a saber, a child suffering all night in a Russian privy, or any of the pages from today's Globe and Mail
that recount similar stories.
They cannot be justified. They are part of a very deep and fundamental mystery about God and the world, which do not admit of any kind of solution. And to find some kind of satisfactory theodicy is in a really dark sense, to violate the sufferers. And Dostoevsky refuses to do that. He simply admits the mystery by showing that while Ivan can think nihilistically, Ivan cannot live nihilistically. That's the contradiction that Dostoevsky exposes as the real answer to Ivan's kind of nihilism. He can think nothing, but he cannot live nothing. If you know much about Dostoevsky's life, I don't know a great deal. Dostoevsky planned to write a sequel to The Brothers K, in which all, Dr. Cottle, all those loose ends would be tied up. In that sequel, he planned, at one point at least, to show Ivan turning insane, but becoming what in the Russian and Eastern tradition is called the holy fool. The man, usually men, who are so mad in their love of God that they're by all worldly standards insane. Most of them go naked, bother to wear clothes. There's a whole long tradition from the Middle Ages of the holy fool. Ivan was to become that, and a wonderful kind of redemption. Let me finish. William says rightly, the real heroes of the book, therefore, are not Alyosha. He's this young monk who has to grow up, and as Zosima says, go out into the world, boy. You don't have enough experience in the world to know how to tell anybody to do anything. You can't be a monk until you've had some worldly experience. The two heroes are Dmitri and Zosima. Dmitri is charged with the crime of killing his father. And it looks as if he did. All the evidence points to him. And you can imagine Freud went into orbit when what all the stuff he had theorized, he found already present in Dostoevsky, where patricide is at the key of the whole book. All three of the brothers want their father dead. Only one commits patricide, that's Smerdyakov, who, unable to live with his nihilism, hangs himself. All the evidence points to Dmitri, and all, therefore, Dmitri has to do is to plead innocent, and he will be let off if his lawyers can make a sufficient case for his innocence. And he refuses. He refuses to plead innocent to a crime of which he was, in fact, deeply, spiritually guilty. And, of course, he doesn't do it by himself. He's no autonomous individual deciding, of my own strength, I will plead guilty. It's only by the ministrations of Grushenka, a former prostitute. So already in prison, attended by Grushenka, you've got a kind of budding Christian community in those two figures. The real hero is Zosima. And Zosima's teaching is rich and multifarious, but it boils down to one phrase. This is my last phrase. All are responsible for all. That is as much an anti-Enlightenment phrase as ever could be uttered. We said earlier, according to the really strict Enlightenment view, I have no responsibility for anybody but myself, my own autonomous preferences and choices, and insofar as I have any relation to any of you, it's only on an individual, single-shot basis. Zosima's call for all to be responsible for all is the ultimate call to Christian solidarity and to Christian community, And this is the real clincher. This is where Rowan Williams really cuts deep. He says the heart of that call is this. All are responsible to make all responsible. You got it? All are responsible to make all responsible for all to make all responsible. You got it? So an ever-spreading, rippling, widening stream of communal solidarity and reconciliation. That's enough for me. I'm very happy to take questions, but I would add that one of my heroes is a professor of writing at Duke University, Reynolds Price, who has a terrible case of MS and therefore has to go about in a wheelchair, but he refuses to be called a disabled person. He says what our euphemisms do is to define people out of existence. So I refuse to call myself hearing impaired or auditorially challenged. I'm just damn deaf. And so my friend Katie will have to field the questions and then repeat them. So questions, please.
So just proceed as what?
Here's one. Listen, Katie.
Just a comment. I mean, when you're talking about the autonomous individual, if you read the career coaches section in business sections, they're like this whole subgroup of people where the rubber really meets the road in terms. It's always, you know, you how to prepare your resume, how to network. Never any clue that, you know, that the fact you lost your job might be due to the imaginations, you know, corporate capitalism. No, it's always, you know, just invites you to just consider yourself this individual, you know, prepare your resume.
Not only is this gentleman made a very valid point, but a more frightening point where Dostoevsky sees it all coming is that when Smerdyakov, who is the even greater intellectual in some sense than Ivan, he's learned all that Ivan has to teach and taken it even further, says, if I don't kill myself, I will strike out for America.
Mark, I think you have a question. Just in my own defense, I didn't really need it all tied up in a ribbon, but I do want to know a little bit more about what happened to people, so I'm glad you left planning an equal to it. Now, my question is, it sounds really great that all are responsible to make all responsible for all, and I have a great respect for Christian community, and I really think that that's where the rubber meets the road. But what happens if I'm living in a culture that would like to make all responsible, to make all responsible for all in a way that that I don't feel I want to do? I'm a palliative care physician, and there's coming down the road, making all responsible to help people, quote-unquote, die with dignity. And what if I don't want to play in that sandbox? You know, how do we work that ethos of making, it sounds really great, but how do we do it and still stay with the truth?
I think I got that one. She has a very forceful, projecting voice. I didn't have time to talk about the Grand Inquisitor scene. But if you remember that scene, the chief objection that the Grand Inquisitor grills Christ with, he said, we came to make men free. We came to give them autonomy. We came to take them out from under your control, Jesus, because Jesus, what you and the church gave them were the three deadliest things, miracle, mystery, and authority. And all of my enlightened friends at Baylor buy that argument that the church is a miracle mongerer that goes out and pulls the wool over people's eyes and mystery and then pounds down on them with an authoritarian structure. When in fact, for Dostoevsky, those are three sacred words.
that a world without miracle is a closed cosmos, which, Dr. Cottle, the modern nation state echoes, tries to. A world without mystery makes precisely the violation of persons that you are protesting against, rightly. But above all, a world without authority of a transcendent kind doesn't know the limits to which others can be made responsible for all. And for Dostoevsky, quite candidly, that authority is the church. The church understood, again, in a way that is, at its core, communal. I said last night, what upsets a lot of my evangelical students at Baylor, and I'm an evangelical, I mean, I plead guilty, is when they tell me that they are solitary Christians. I asked a student of mine, what does it mean to be a Christian? She said, I pray, I read my Bible every day, I go to Christian study groups, and I ask Jesus to get me a parking place. And he does. That's what it means to be a Christian. I said to her, not let me refute all four of those items. I asked her, have you been baptized? She said, no, why do I need that? I said, my friend, you're not a Christian. You're not my sister. She thought she was. In other words, for her, solitary, individualistic, autonomous Christianity, which is a total contradiction in terms, has conspired to make her into a complete antithesis of all are responsible for all. There was a time in which one's baptism was the highest event of one's life. Think of it today. Right here.
How does Rowan Williams deal with Dostoevsky's demolition of the theodicies?
His demolition of the theodicies.
Oh. He commends the diminishment of the theodicies. Because, as I try to suggest, the motto of the Council of Florence in 1214 is the motto adopted by Hans Urs von Balthasar, who is Rowan Williams' real theological hero. And at the Council of Florence in 1214, the motto adopted was, we, through the Christian life, become ever more like God and ever more unlike God. So that every descent into the depths of the knowledge of God means an ever increasing ignorance about the nature of God. And that if we can't accept that mystery of ever greater knowledge and ever greater ignorance, of ever greater likeness and ever greater unlikeness, he might as well cash it in. That's what the early church got at through the reading of John's Gospel at the very beginning. That's what we lost, largely in the Enlightenment. As I said, Leibniz, the ultimately Enlightenment thinker, invents the word theodicy. And do you know why he invented it? Because of an earthquake in Lisbon. Hell's bells. What would he have done about the 20th century, the bloodiest century in the history of humankind? 180 million people slaughtered, more than in all centuries combined. Talk about theodicy. There's the need for theodicy if you believe that one can be provided. And I think insofar as one can be provided, and it can't be in any real satisfactory terms, it is the horrible evil is the horrible consequence of human freedom. And if you, by the way, if you don't have an eschatology, you are in real trouble. Because Father Zosima says to those mothers watch their babies die in those horrific fashions. He says you must weep as Rachel weeps in the Jewish Bible. For if you don't weep over the death of those children and say, oh dear kind God needed him a little angel and therefore took them, you are unfaithful to that God. However, just as the Jews put a statutory limitation on the time of grief after the death of the loved one, grief must be transcended into joy. And Zosima talks at length about the nature of Christian joy that doesn't negate Rachel's screams that are valid, but is transmuted in and through the love of God in the mystery of God.
You mentioned that, I'm not sure if you can clarify whether it was your belief or Cavill's belief that he rejects his successes being an existential pro-existential writer. I believe you were sort of, you said his essence as a Sartian idea of existentialism. Do you think he could possibly work with Kierkegaard?
Good question. I'll repeat that since as one who has ears to hear but hears not. He asks, if Dostoevsky cannot be reconciled with Sartre, Camus, Heidegger, and the like, could he be reconciled with a Christian existentialist such as Søren Kierkegaard, the Great Dane? And the answer is no. Kierkegaard's motto is subjectivity is truth. Kierkegaard, without knowing it, protesting against the hegemony of the nation-state established Lutheran Church of Denmark, turned right around and made the modern mistake of exalting the solitary individual alone before God. And therefore, it seems to me, Kierkegaard could not be reconciled, or Dostoevsky to Kierkegaard. I wish it were so. I love Kierkegaard. But I would quote to you a wonderful saying from Karl Barth. Karl Barth said, no one can be a Christian in the modern world without going by way of Kierkegaard. But woe be unto him who stops with Kierkegaard. And I stopped for a long time, so I'm confessing sin. I'm not casting stones here. I was a lot older than you were, young man, when I had to find out the limits of Kierkegaard. So you're ahead of me.
We have time for maybe one more.
So the modern world, at least in the West, is speak up.
Yeah.
The modern Western world is characterized by just the nation state. That's the context we find ourselves in, and if that's at opposition with a true Christian way of being, how are we to respond to that? How are we to live as citizens of the nation state?
Yeah. Good. The question to repeat, if the modern nation state is as hegemonic as I have declared, and I think it is in Canada, no less than in the U.S., in radically different ways, how then shall we live as Christians? The way is by being radically subversive, as well as the early church. The early church faced a situation not at all unlike ours, because it faced the Roman Imperium, in which Christians were tolerated at first as a very small minority. Only after they had first of all been persecuted for being subversives. I think we have to be subversive. And by that I mean, the church needs to be a community of Christians living in such a way as to call the attention of the modern secular state to persecute us.
And we aren't doing that. I'm fond of quoting Chesterton, who said, "Our Lord commanded us to forgive our enemies, but not to have none." His point was, if anyone is making a very strong witness, he's going to make enemies. And it's across the board. Does anyone know who wrote the one letter of from a major source against the execution of Timothy McVeigh? Anybody know who he is? He blew up the Murrah building in Oklahoma City, killing 110 people, and was fried, as we do it in the U.S. What major figure in world culture wrote a letter of protest against his execution? John Paul II. John Paul II vehemently opposed the war in Iraq. So yeah, I think we have to be subversives. I think we have to. Therefore, not to retreat into our private little ghettos. That's the worst thing we could do. I used the example last night that by the year 96 AD, in the writing of what's called the Didache, the first kind of short summary of Christian teaching, at the core of that teaching is that Christians don't kill their babies. That's from the very start. Because abortion is nowhere mentioned in the New Testament, or in the Old, for that matter. Christians began, therefore, rescuing babies that were exposed to the elements as a way, of course, performing infanticide, and rearing those babies to adulthood. So we have no right to be against abortion if we're not for adoption. I talked with a student of mine from Regent College last night. A fellow who has, if I can use the PC term, a very severe disability. He and his wife have adopted 3 orphan children. Now that's a protest. That's a subversion of the abortifacient culture that we live in. And there are dozens of examples like that. In every American church of a Protestant kind, there is one single item of decor that can be found. Does anyone know what it is?
Cross.
What?
Cross.
No. Wish it were. He answered the cross. He got it wrong. The American flag. In every Protestant church in America, there is an American flag. Not a cross. I grew up in a Baptist church who thought that was Catholic. Awful, awful stuff. There is a church in Killeen, Texas, the home of Fort Hood, the home of 2 entire, not companies, I forget the military term, it's where all the soldiers are shipped out for Iraq, that on July the 4th, Sunday that came nearest to it, had a procession down the central aisle of soldiers carrying fixed bayonets with the flag between them, and the service began with a pledge of allegiance to the American flag. You get my drift? That's a church in bed with the culture, doing anything but acting as a subversive to the culture. So yeah, we need to be communal, not individual, communal subversives.
So does that necessitate opposition to democracy?
Whoa. I think the hour is now over. He asked a very uncomfortable question. Does that necessitate opposition to democracy? I can cite you a great pagan philosopher who said yes, Plato. And this is a looming problem. Are you aware that Hitler did not perform a single illegal act in his program for the extermination of the Jews? He was, first of all, elected to office, not by majority, but by plurality. And so he saw to it that every act he performed in exterminating Jews and Gypsies and homosexuals was legal. You've got a problem on your hands.
a very real problem. I'm going to get shot, so I better leave.
Last thing, I'm doing one more time.